From Katanning to Lafayette Hill, La Trobe to Bloomsburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the November general election is now just days away, and Pennsylvania is ground zero in the battle for control of the U.S. Congress. Veteran political consultant Chris Nicholas of Eagle Consulting is here with an overview. And it is called Operation Healing Forces, an organization dedicated to helping our most highly trained service members deal with life after a catastrophic injury. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Jeff Hudson in the Community Benefit Spotlight. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Chris Nicholas of Eagle Consulting in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. After a delay of nearly 4 years, the trial of State Representative Vanessa Lowry Brown, who is accused of taking bribes as part of a sting operation, is now underway. Brown switched attorneys a number of times and appealed her indictments in the appellate court system. Brown won her party's primary last May and is up for re-election next week. The Philadelphia lawmaker has continued to serve in office, collecting a salary and accumulating pension time while awaiting trial. The film Gosnell has debuted nationwide and focuses on the story of Philadelphia abortion doctor Kermit Gosnell, who is now serving 3 consecutive life terms for murdering full-term babies after they were born. The film's producer, Ann McElhaney, has termed Gosnell America's biggest serial killer. Speaking at a recent banquet hosted by the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation, McElhaney was highly critical of state officials who failed to properly monitor the abortion facility. Although the film is now showing at theaters nationwide, numerous roadblocks were thrown in the path of those seeking to tell the Gosnell horror story, including Facebook blocking ads for the film. Governor Tom Wolf has vetoed a bill that passed both houses of the General Assembly with bipartisan support that would have helped Pennsylvanians on welfare achieve independence by moving into the workforce. The legislation also would have prioritized medical coverage for those who need it most, including those unable to work due to medical conditions, parents of young children, and the elderly. The bill would also have required able-bodied adults capable of working to either work 20 hours per week or attend classes that would help them prepare to enter the workforce in order to continue receiving state assistance. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Voters in Penns Woods are about to head to the polls to elect a governor, U.S. senator, members of Congress, and state lawmakers. Joining us now to take a look at the key races and some of the unique dynamics at play in this election is Chris Nicholas. Chris is a veteran Republican political consultant who operates Eagle Consulting. Chris, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Chris, let's start out. Of course, you have all the national issues that have been at play, particularly since the whole confirmation hearing process with Justice Kavanaugh. Let's talk first about the U.S. Senate race, the top race in Pennsylvania. What are the dynamics this year?
Well, you've got a well-entrenched incumbent Loman in Senator Bob Casey Jr., who is running for his third term as senator. And of course, he served a couple terms as Auditor General and Treasurer before he became senator. So he's been on ballots here for 20-plus years. You have the Republican nominee, U.S. Congressman Lou Barletta. And ironically, Barletta and Casey live probably, 20, 25 minutes away from each other. They're both in northeastern PA, which we call NEPA, N-E-P-A, NEPA. So I'm curious to see which candidate carries NEPA, because there's two local sons of NEPA there. So I'm curious to see what happens there. I'm curious to see what happens in the state's largest media market, which is Philadelphia, which is about 40-41% of the total vote. So I think that will be key. Places like Philadelphia have so far been more difficult places for Republicans since President Trump came to office. You can't pick up a newspaper or go online without seeing polling saying that Trump is having issues with college-educated white women. Now, on the flip side, President Trump and Republicans do better with the opposite of that, non-college educated men. So a lot of what happens in the midterms is, what is the turnout? In 2010, the year of the Tea Party, we had a lot more of those non-college educated men turn out than normal. This year, the expectation is we'll have more of the college educated white women. So Republicans are doing poorly with that group. So if that group turns out in higher proportions, well, then that will obviously accrue to the benefit of the Democrats. The other issue is, in looking at national polling, is, and this holds true for our congressional races as well, that's national. Every little congressional district has its own dynamics. As I say in my presentations across Pennsylvania, the issue for President Trump is that in the places where he's still popular, Republicans, with a few exceptions, pretty much already own everything. There's not a lot of room to grow. Okay, we could look at Pennsylvania's congressional districts because of the political environment and the state Supreme Court drawing new districts in February. You could see one or fewer Republican Congress in all of the Philadelphia TV market in 41% of the state. That's how tough it is. And I think Republicans in the rural areas will do better than before, but it doesn't really make a difference if you get 63% of the vote or 67%, right? You're still going to win. The problem is in some of these suburban areas. And as I remind people, we don't have suburbs only just in Philadelphia. We have suburbs around Allentown, around Harrisburg, of course, around Pittsburgh, even in Erie. So those are places where you have higher concentrations of those college-educated white women that Republicans are having special trouble with now.
Let's talk a little about those suburbs and areas outside of Philadelphia suburbs, which it's obvious that Republicans are going to lose 3 or 4 congressional seats in that area. A couple of them are actually vacant at the moment.
Yeah, we had 2 congressmen resign, and then the districts got re-gerrymandered. So given that the Democrats have a clear advantage in the new districts, 4, which is Montgomery County, 5, which is Delaware County, and 6, which is primarily Chester County, one of the big battles is between incumbent Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick in the Bucks County district, which is now, after 100 years of being the 8th district, is now has to be the 1st district for some reason. And his opponent, Henry Wallace, has a lot of his own money. They've been fighting back and forth. Fitzpatrick is a moderate. He did not vote for the repeal and replace bills that came through a year ago. He has a bunch of union support. That district went from being +1 or +2 Republican to being like +2 Democrat. So it's real barn burner in Bucks County and then all across the Philadelphia media market because that's where they're buying the ads.
Now, in the other suburban areas, we are seeing really tight races. And you referenced Allentown, where Charlie Dent has left an open seat. Scott Perry in the Harrisburg area is in a competitive race. Mike Kelly, who has Erie in his district. And Keith Rothfuss, what does it look like for those 4 races?
I think Congressman Kelly will probably be okay. He has personal assets of his own that if he needs to really open the checkbook, he can do that. I think in Pittsburgh, we're going to switch seats. You're going to have Connor Lamb, the Democrat who won in a special election, beat Keith Rothfuss. But then in the district that Connor Lamb was actually elected to, you're going to have Republican State Senator Guy Reschenthaler take that. So we're going to flop seats, I think, in western Pennsylvania, going to lose a couple in southeastern Pennsylvania. And the one that is really intriguing is the one you mentioned between Congressman Scott Perry in the 10th district. The Democrat Supreme Court went to great lengths to draw a competitive seat in central Pennsylvania. And the way they did that is they put York City, Harrisburg, and Carlisle in the same district. And that gave that district a good base for Democrats. So that's the one I'll be looking at, Scott Perry, the Republican incumbent, and George Scott, the Democrat. And Mr. Scott, he is a Lutheran pastor. And before that, he spent 20 years fighting for his country as a member of Army intelligence. So some of the traditional ways that Republicans go after Democrats, he can naturally blunt because a lot of his advertising shows him in his pastor's frock and in his old Army intelligence uniform.
Although he did in the primary air a commercial actually setting fire to a firearm because he is so vehemently anti-gun in an area that is...
Yeah, he's not going to do that this election, and he's already said that himself. But it was an interesting ad to literally see somebody have a pile of wood burning and then take apart a gun and throw it in there.
We are, by the way, talking with Chris Nicholas, veteran Republican political consultant. He with Eagle Consulting. We have the November general election coming up in just a little over a week now. And we've been talking about all the federal races. We have some very important state races led by the campaign for governor, Governor Tom Wolf, running for re-election after Governor Tom Corbett failed to secure a second term, the first time that's ever happened. Will Tom Wolf see history repeat itself, or is he on a track to getting us back to that eight-year cycle?
If you look at generally available public polling, Tom Wolf is ahead of his Republican challenger, Scott Wagner. So a lot of the attention has been on the legislative races. Republicans have historic levels of representation in both the state House and in the state Senate. The state Senate has all 25 of its even-numbered seats up. Even-numbered Senate seats run with the governor, odds run with the president. So through a quirk of that numbering system, 7 of the 8 Republican state senators in southeastern Pennsylvania are up for election this year because they have even-numbered districts. So every Republican state senator in that part of the state except for Tom Killian, who's in an odd-numbered district. So the Democrats have a good canvas to play on because of that, as I said, a quirk in the numbering system. If they run the table there, they're still not at the majority, and they're obviously not going to run the table. But as I do my presentations around the state, I caution business leaders that, look, you have to accept the fact that there are going to be fewer Republican elected members of Congress and the state legislature on November 7th than there were going into November 6th.
In all fairness, however, whenever we look at the numbers in the state House and state Senate, you have 34 out of 50 Republicans. That's a two-thirds majority. That's at least in recent history an all-time high. Same thing in the House of Representatives, 120 out of 221 out of 203.
It's the highest since Eisenhower's second term. So
the pendulum has swung pretty far in the Republican direction. Wouldn't you assume that Pennsylvania politics, which tends to be fairly even, Stephen, that it would be time for that to swing back anyhow?
There's that. And also on the Republican side, you have an inordinate number of Republicans who have retired early, run for something else. So Republicans are defending 21 open seats. Open seats are the ones most likely to flip Lohman because, as you know, there's no incumbent in that district. That's why we call it an open seat. Democrats are protecting, I think, fewer than half of that number of open seats. So yes, it is historic levels of Republican representation. And most Democrats went into this cycle, 2018, thinking, well, we'll get some solid wins and then it sets us up for 2020. But I think you could see the Democrats have more than quote unquote solid wins across the state. I think this is reminding me of 1994. If some of your viewers are older like the two of us, they remember that big contract with America year when the Republicans picked up, I believe, 53 seats. And you had
The U.S. Congress we're talking about.
In the U.S. Congress. That was a throwing the baby out with the bathwater type of election. So you had good Democrats thrown out and not too great Republicans put in. So I think you could see that on the state legislative level here where you have some hardworking Republicans because of the political environment lose 52-48 rather than winning 52-48. That just gives Republicans like me more targets to go after in 2020. But it does have – obviously creates a different circumstance here in 2018.
And we do have a trend, another trend that's been at play here, Chris, where Republicans have been losing to the degree they've been losing legislative seats, have been seeing them erode in the southeast outside of Philadelphia. But the West, however, has been colored almost outside of the city of Pittsburgh, almost entirely red. Is there still room for Republicans to grow a bit this cycle in the western part of the state?
You know, I think we've won with maybe one or two exceptions. Pretty much everything as you said, outside Pittsburgh, the great pickup area for Republicans has been greater non-urban southwest Pennsylvania. So basically between Johnstown and Pittsburgh, but not in the cities. So again, this being a tough political environment for Republicans, it'll shield some of those Democrats that probably should lose. There are a couple seats in the north central part of the state that could flip as well. And the odd thing is we've got a couple seats this year, two in the House and one in the Senate, where sons are running to replace their fathers who have served a long time. So it'll be interesting to look at those one state Senate seat in Southeast PA, one House seat in North Central PA, and one House seat in Southwest PA.
We again have been talking with veteran Republican political consultant Chris Nicholas with Eagle Consulting. Chris, where can folks go to learn more?
Folks can go to my website, eagleconsult.com, or even better, follow me on Twitter, which is at Eagle63.
Chris Nicholas of Eagle Consulting. Chris, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Loman.
Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, and other highly trained and specialized members of the military sometimes incur career-ending wounds in the line of duty. They then face the task of reintegrating into civilian life. Operation Healing Forces helps them to do just that. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation learns more from the executive director of Operation Healing Forces, Jeff Hudson. Joe?
Thank you, Loman, and thank you, Jeff, for being a guest on the Lincoln Radio program. Jeff, can you share with our listeners the inspiration for starting this organization, Operation Healing Forces? What inspired this organization to come together?
How this began, a gentleman by the name of Mr. Gary Markell, a Florida businessman, he was watching a television show one night of wounded soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines returning from war, and they were trying to relearn how to scuba dive after having some horrific wounds, missing limbs, gunshot wounds, IED blasts, and saw these guys moving on a beach, many of them having to crawl through the sand, and it really touched his heart. He wanted to find a way to help, a way to give back, and to say thank you to them and their families for service to our country. So at the time, he knew, and he still knows, General Doug Brown, who was the commander of Special Operations Command at the time, and reached out to General Brown. And Gary has a yacht, and he's like, hey, I would love to host a group of these guys who fought for our country and are continuing to do so on board my yacht. And General Brown, shortly after 9/11, Special Operations, the nature of warfare really changed because Special Operations really started to be used a great deal more than the United States had ever used special ops in the past actively. And so as a result of that, we also started to see a greater rise in casualties. And it takes anywhere from 8 to 10 years to grow a seasoned special operator. They are the military's utmost elite. And so General Brown, seeing the rise in casualties, had started a program called Care Coalition, or also known as the Special Operations Warrior Care Program, where anyone that got wounded, ill, or injured seriously in Special Operations would be assigned an advocate to try to help them recover, rehabilitate, and then get back to the force and get back to the fight. Or if their wounds are so severe, and they have to then transition successfully back into civilian life. And so they had what then was called Operation Cruise. Gary started a nonprofit, Mr. Markell did, and they had their first retreat. And one of the very unique things was that Gary and his wife Denise thought of is it's not just the service member, it's their spouse, because the spouse is part of the team too.
I think a lot of people listening to the program, Jeff, understands that it's like when someone in the family has a traumatic brain injury or someone in the family has special needs, it doesn't just happen to the individual, it happens to the whole family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Too many times the family becomes the collateral damage. As a doctor one time told me, it's overseas when you're deployed, you learn these survival mechanisms. They keep you and your teammates alive. Well, those survival mechanisms that get ingrained to you because you've seen them successful downrange, you bring those back and you end up bringing them back into your home. You bring them back to your family. And it doesn't equate very well with a family lifestyle or family culture a lot of times. And so then you've got a couple of things. You've got guys that may have post-traumatic stress, but the symptoms also are very similar to a traumatic brain injury. For anyone that's ever seen the movie Concussion with the NFL, think about that for a special operator, that not only is he receiving concussions from blunt force trauma, whether he's in a fight or whether he's practicing combatives or whether he's falling out of an airplane with a parachute and he hits his head on the ground, but he's also receiving traumatic brain injuries that are cumulative in nature from overpressure of blast, whether sure. it's an IED, whether it's a Carl Gustav round, whether it is door charges that have been done hundreds of times, that's still affecting his brain over time. And so those things coupled together, then sometimes he's either can be quick to temper, quick to anger, as well as quick to take action. And a lot of times, sometimes it does not always fit well in a family setting. Yet overseas, that's what he needs to be able to do and perform. And then a lot of times he'll suppress a lot of memories that happen overseas because he cannot let that get in the way of his mission.
Right.
And then yet when he gets back home and that slows down, then those can come back to him.
Jeff, I know that for your organization, it's so important to have the right leadership. And I hope this doesn't embarrass you, but I'd like to share with the listeners who you are. You're a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. You served in special operations for 8 deployments into Afghanistan and Iraq. You're a 1993 graduate of West Point. When you parachuted into Afghanistan and then Iraq, one of those times you were injured. Your spine was injured, and you were brought home for rehab. And you, while you're rehabbing, you earned a Master's of Science degree in defense analysis with a concentration in irregular warfare. You received the Legion of Merit Award, 2 Bronze Stars, 3 Meritorious Service Awards, and the Combat Infantryman's Badge. So you're the real deal, and the other staff in the organization are the real deal as well. But I don't know if our listeners know, what's the difference between a special operations soldier and a regular combat soldier or other parts of the military?
Gotcha. Thank you for that intro. And the only reason I was able to do that was because of, I definitely have to first thank God, and then I had and was honored and privileged to work with very good people and had a wonderful wife back home that kept things together. But so for special operations, in all of the Department of Defense, there's only about 68,000 roughly people in special operations, under the special operations umbrella, if you will. Out of that 68,000, there's only roughly about around 15 to 20,000 that are actually what I would call door kickers or the elite special operators that are stepping out in harm's way every day and every night. So roughly, special operations forces make up about 3.5% of the U.S. military. And out of that, elite operators only make up about 8 to 10% of that number. And so when I talk about special operations forces, I'm talking about guys like Green Berets on 12-man A-teams, Night Stalkers out of the 160th, SEALs, Air Force Special Tactics, Marine Raiders, and Rangers out of the Ranger Battalions. Those are, and there are other units out there as well. Some remain hidden in the shadows. Others work in and out of the shadows. But we're talking about the very top or tip of the spear, if you will, out of all of America's military forces.
This is Joe Geiger in the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Jeff Hudson. He's the executive director of an organization called Operation Healing Forces and also a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Army. Jeff, what are the goals of Operation Healing Forces? What do you hope to accomplish with the services that you provide?
Our mission with Operation Healing Forces is to serve the needs of our active duty and recent veteran, wounded, ill, and injured Special Operations Forces and their spouses by starting or continuing the process of mentally, physically, and emotionally healing in preparation to return them to the fight or help them successfully transition into civilian life.
And that trust comes pretty quickly when they know who the facilitators of the retreat are, and they know that their peer group at this retreat are like and similar situations to what they experienced.
Absolutely. They've all, whether it's a SEAL, a Ranger, a Green Beret, a Marine Raider, they've all served in similar areas. They've all been on similar missions. And unfortunately, they've all lost friends that they may know. And so as they realize, they're not going to be stuck in a room. They're not going to be analyzed by shrinks or docs or anything like that. It is a group of brothers and sisters coming together to see a better side of life in a good part of the United States and be able to talk about some of the things they've been through and how to prepare for the road ahead.
And they develop a little bit of a peer group where the military can see there are other guys going through the same, guys being male and female, going through the same kinds of challenges I'm going through, and the spouses can also develop that kind of a support group.
Absolutely. We've got over 97% of our folks that have been through our program tell us that they made some of their best friends on a retreat and still stay in touch today, even though they may live at different areas of the country.
I can imagine as these folks graduate out of the retreat that they're very motivated and very comforted by what happened. What's the power that keeps them going once they leave?
I think one of the big things, it's almost an epiphany, if you will, when folks come on one of these retreats is, and this happened to me too at the very beginning years ago, is that you arrive and you're not quite sure what to expect. You're almost thinking like, you know, this sounds too good to be true. And then you get there and you realize that someone is not only donating their home for you to stay in and allow you to sleep in their bed and provide you meals and activities, not just for you, but also for your wife, that probably one of the most powerful things is people start to realize that people care. Too many times these guys are deploying and it's not in the news. And October 7th, just this past couple of weeks, marked the 17th year of the war. And very few people realize that special operations have been continually deploying into combat now for 17 years.
Jeff, what you're talking about has to be very rewarding, but it also has to be very exhausting. So at the end of the day, how do you know you're making a difference? I've read the book with the testimonials that have come in, and it's amazing. Would you share one or two of those?
One of the quotes that always stays with me, and there's several, but I had a gentleman come up about day three of the retreat. He said, "Hey, Jeff, you know there are 22 veteran suicides a day." And I said, "Yeah, I've heard that." He's like, "Well, you know, tomorrow there will only be 21. I looked at him like, "Kind of, you know, what do you mean by that?" He said, "Well, because of this retreat, because this happened, yeah, I won't be one of those 22 tomorrow."
Boy, that's incredibly moving. If anyone listening to this program would like more information, how can they find you?
Our website is www.operationhealingforces.org. And on there, there's various information. They're also welcome. We have contact information out there. If there's anything additional they would like to know, they're more than welcome to contact me or us off of that site.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Jeff Hudson, retired Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army and the executive director of an organization called Operation Healing Forces. But I want to thank you for being a guest on our program, and I want to thank you for what you're doing for so many people that don't get the thank yous they deserve.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 23 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WIOV-FM in Ephrata, WMCE-FM in Erie, along with WERG-FM at Gannon University in Erie, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.